It wasn't until Peter Carl produced the Unix source codes from Hess that Sergei made a first substantial payment of 25,000 marks, about $12,500, in 100 mark notes. Carl noticed that on the lists he kept, Sergei had crossed out Unix and written 25,000 next to it. Carl also noticed that a notation for IBM's VM operating system had been crossed out and 50,000 had been scribbled next to it. Curiously, VMS was also scratched out, even though Carl hadn't yet been able to deliver it. Acknowledging Carl's confusion, Sergei remarked, "You have competition." After that, the payments amounted to 3,000 marks here and 5,000 marks there for bits of software that Sergei thought were worth something. Carl's practice was to keep at least half of the money for himself and dispense the balance to the provider of the goods. After all, he figured, why not keep at least half the money when he was doing the dirty work? Carl had lost his job at the Hanover Casino in the midst of a highly publicized table-fixing scandal, so the income from the Soviet business was becoming important to him. Still, no one was getting rich from the scheme, and by the time the whole business was over, Sergei would dispense roughly 90,000 marks to the group. After his meeting with Sergei, Pengo was hacking as often as he could. He broke into the Japanese branch of Lotus Development Corporation, but found nothing. Every time Carl dropped by on his way to see Sergei, Pengo had to tell him he had nothing to offer. His ability to hack interrupted was a function of his access to passwords and NUIs, and by the end of 1986, stolen NUIs had a much shorter useful life. The Bundespost had developed far more sophisticated means of tracking down abused NUIs. In fact, once a NUI was discovered, if it was shared, it disappeared within a few days. So hackers had stopped sharing NUIs. Pengo, too, guarded the ones he used closely. With a NUI in hand, he could stay online for at least 2 weeks, doing nothing but hacking. Without one, he stayed offline, stoned most of the time, programming here and there, occasionally hitting up Dob for a good meal and some hash. Pengo was beginning to be extremely careful with his work. He tried to maintain as low a profile as possible. When he was breaking into computers on the EasyNet, Digital Equipment's internal electronic mail network, and the place where he thought he might find VMS source code, he probed only as much as he knew was safe without being detected. But it was a frustrating exercise. Aside from the source code and compilers, Pengo suspected Sergei wanted not just any military material, but information on sensitive military networks, along with detailed information about the logical setup of the U.S. military machine in order to infiltrate it. But to find that kind of information, he wasn't sure where to begin. He became less and less willing to share information with others, such as those from the Hamburg chaos scene. He had already made the mistake of telling Obelix and the others about the digital computer in Singapore, and within a few days, the machine was locked down. Now that he was to make a livelihood from hacking, the stakes seemed higher. It wasn't ideology that made Pengo want to be a paid hacker for the Soviets. Despite what he had said to Sergei, Pengo didn't feel particularly strongly about politics. He hadn't exactly lied. He did come from Berlin's leftist scene, and he was sympathetic, at least in vague terms, with what Gorbachev was trying to achieve in the Soviet Union. He had developed a strong sympathy for West Germany's 8-year-old Green Party, which stood for the preservation of a threatened environment and opposition to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy, and was, for a time at least, gaining a stronghold in Berlin. And Pengo was an avid reader of the left-wing newspaper Tageszeitung. Occasionally, he even fancied himself an anarchist, a fitting image for a young man from Berlin. But he was skeptical of the others' talk of world peace through hacking, their justification for Project Equalizer. Pengo suspected that Carl and the others were motivated mainly by money. But Pengo had other reasons for what he was doing. Being a paid hacker, traveling over to East Berlin and dealing with the Russians were simply extensions of his life in front of the computer, the same life that alienated and mystified his family. Pengo believed that he was upholding a commitment to hacking as a thing in itself. Part of this idea had come from reading Neuromancer, an intense and chilling science fiction novel populated with high-tech lowlifes. Written in 1984 by William Gibson, the book came to define what later was called cyberpunk. The novel's protagonist, a drug-addicted computer cowboy named Case, is presented with the opportunity to save his rapidly decaying life by breaking into computer networks and stealing data. Neuromancer became Pengo's personal cyberpunk primer. After reading it, Pengo decided that if he hadn't already established himself with a nickname, he would have chosen Case. In Pengo's reality, working for the Russians held its own justification. It was something Case would have done. Pengo knew vaguely what was written in the German law books, that selling so much as a page torn from a Western German phone book to the KGB was espionage. But he didn't really connect that to what he was doing. He was doing what he had always done, hacking. And now someone was acknowledging his talent. Late in 1986, a few weeks after Pengo's trip to East Berlin, Daub had given Pengo another sizable chunk of money, thousands of marks to pay his phone bill. The money was meant to defray the costs of hacking with a legitimate Nui, but Pengo was still using stolen Nuis. He used the money to buy a Sony Walkman, a telephone answering machine, and some records. In fact, he set up an impressive computer center in his bedroom at his father's apartment. He was teaching himself Unix and had put together a computer, a decent modem, and a printer. It was a purloined Nui that got Pengo into trouble a few months after his meeting with Sergei. When the Society of German Engineers noticed that its Bundespost bill for DATEX-P use was 100 times the monthly average, the association complained to the Bundespost, which traced the unauthorized use of the Nui to one Gottfried Hübner in West Berlin. One night, shortly after the trace had been completed, Pengo's phone suddenly went dead. He called the Bundespost to complain. The line was connected again. On December 1st, at 9 a.m., Pengo was roused from his sleep by 3 officers from the West Berlin police. He remained perfectly calm and asked to see their search warrants. After several hours of searching every possible corner of Gottfried's apartment, the police confiscated all the computer-related evidence they could find, but they forgot one vital piece of equipment, the hard disk where all of the computer's information was stored. A few weeks later, they returned for it, but Pengo just shrugged his shoulders and said he didn't know what they were talking about. He was eventually accused of concealing evidence and was fined for his unregistered modem. It had been a close call, but Pengo's father was more upset than Pengo, not at his son's transgression, but at the invasion of police into the apartment. As 1987 went by, Pengo kept working for Sergei, but he wasn't making much progress in finding things the Soviets might want. Once a month he got a call from Peter Karl, who was on his way to his regular meeting with Sergei, whether he had something to take with him or not. Showing up empty-handed was embarrassing. "Have you got anything?" Karl asked Pengo each time. "No," was the response more often than not. Pengo knew he wasn't living up to his part of whatever haphazard arrangement he was involved in. But breaking into systems was getting more difficult, because mostly Nuis were so much harder to get. So he asked Peter Karl to give him Karl's own Nui, explaining that without a Nui he could always rely on, he was at a distinct disadvantage. Karl agreed. What Karl didn't expect, however, was that Pengo would use the Nui for weeks on end and run up a bill of 4,000 marks, or about $2,000, in 1 month. Karl's patience, with both Pengo and Hagbard, was wearing thin. Karl hadn't fully forgiven Pengo for spending an entire night at the Hotel Schweizerhof the previous summer, talking a big line, smoking lots of Dobbs hash, and coming up with nothing particularly worthwhile. Sergei, moreover, was pressing Karl to cut Hagbard off from the group because of his heavy drug addiction and his habit of talking too much. Daub, too, had proved a disappointment to Sergei. Daub's motivation was flagging, and he hadn't produced any source code for the Siemens computers he was so expert in. Karl had even taken Daub to East Berlin a second time so that Sergei could try to get him motivated, but he was increasingly indifferent. Marcus Hess was the only one who seemed to have Sergei's respect. Sergei told Karl he was glad that Hess didn't take drugs and pleased that Hess had come up with the source code to Berkeley Unix. Most impressive to Sergei was Hess's expertise in U.S. military computers. Indeed, Hess was the only one who came through with any regularity. Gradually, it seemed, the scheme had deteriorated from the great hope of the million-mark coup to just seeing what they could get away with. Some of Sergei's more gullible purchases, in fact, originated with Hess. As soon as Minix, an operating system with the look and feel of Unix, came into the Focus office in late 1987, Hess copied it and handed the copy to Carl. Sergey handed Carl 4,000 marks, $2,000, for the software. When Sergey later discovered, apparently from reading an American computer magazine, that Minix source code normally sold for 120 marks, he was furious. But that didn't stop Hess. A few months later, Hess filled a disk with Unix software, freely distributed at the last European Unix user group meeting, and Carl sold it to Sergey for 2,000 marks. When Sergey found out that it was all public domain software, he warned Carl never again to sell him something like that. Carl's reaction was indifferent. At least Hess was producing. Pengo couldn't even come up with a list of passwords. Dobb, too, was losing his patience with Pengo. More than anything, Pengo just seemed irresponsible and self-absorbed. For months, Pengo had been using Dobb's Rainbow computer, a digital computer similar to an IBM personal computer. When Dobb left for vacation in Nairobi in the summer of 1987, he asked Pengo to retrieve from the computer a bill for work Dobb had done and send it on to his employer. Despite profuse promises, the matter slipped Pengo's mind, and the bill remained untouched in the computer. Dobb flew to Kenya via Amsterdam, but on his way back from Kenya, the flight made a stop in Hanover. He was arrested almost immediately at the airport on charges of evading his military obligation. Dobb sat for weeks in prison in Hanover, and it wasn't until he saw his funds dwindle to nothing that he discovered Pengo hadn't done the small favor he had asked of him. It translated to a loss of nearly 10,000 marks for Dobb. To further erode their friendship, when the Rainbow broke, Pengo neglected to have it fixed. Then, in the late summer of 1988, the hack that was to focus world attention on the Chaos Club happened. The NASA hack, as it came to be called, had been started innocently enough by a group of Chaos hackers as a simple if all-consuming game of seeing how many computers could be reached on the space agency's vast SPAN computer network. The NASA hackers did it by inserting an ingenious piece of software of their own invention into VMS version 4.5. VMS 4.5 was approximately the 28th iteration of Digital's operating system. Each time an operating system is updated and new features are added, new security flaws almost inevitably arise. Often they go unnoticed. When a small group of Chaos hackers discovered a flaw in VMS 4.5, they seized on it and wrote what they called the Loginout Patch. It was a clever little Trojan horse program embedded in the VMS source code designed to collect passwords on any computer they entered. And it was the very piece of code that Kevin Mitnick and Lenny DeSico would chance upon a year later and use to infiltrate scores of Digital's own computers. In two computers named Castor and Pollux at NASA headquarters in Washington, the group had found shuttle proposals and reports on booster rockets. This was not particularly sensitive information, but NASA didn't necessarily want its files opened up to a pack of curious West German computer hackers. Obelix, who was part of the group, had been keeping a list of all the computers they penetrated, but there came a time when the hackers lost count of the machines they had infected with their Loginout patch. It could have been 150, or it could have been 500. They began to fear that the Trojan horse could run out of control. Someone more malicious than curious could find it, copy it, install it in another computer, and cause some real damage. It was time to notify someone official. Their first idea was to inform Digital itself and leave the problem in the company's hands. But after thinking it through, they decided it might not be the best idea. Digital was likely to respond with a call to the police. Their next thought was to alert the American ambassador, but they rejected that idea because they decided he probably wouldn't understand what they were talking about. The NASA hackers decided to tell Vau Holland and Stefan Verneri. The two Chaos leaders weren't sure how to react, so they called two television journalists, Thomas Amann and Matthias Lenhardt. At 31, Thomas Amann was well established as a freelance television journalist who did most of his work for Panorama, a West German television magazine. Amann specialized in technology and, of course, the German hacking scene. 37-year-old Lenhardt was Amman's terse and cynical partner. The journalists sat down with the Chaos leaders, who told them the story and said they were planning to inform the authorities. Eager to save the story for themselves, the journalists tried to discourage them. They argued that it would just bring an unwelcome investigation and put Chaos in a bad light. But Vow and Stefan thought the material they were sitting on was too sensitive to withhold. Eventually, they reasoned, it would come out anyway. A few days later, they called a contact who, they believed, might know who to call at the Verfassungsschutz, a West German agency roughly equivalent to a domestic CIA, and they asked their contact to inform the agency. As it turned out, the agency itself wasn't sure what to do with this odd indirect confession. Without informing DEC or NASA of the problem, the Verfassungsschutz simply sat on the matter. Amman and Lenhardt decided to force the matter into the open and rushed to put together a program for Panorama about the hack. NASA refused to comment. Digital Public Relations, holding firmly to a policy of refusing comment on sensitive matters, didn't return the journalists' telephone calls. After a dozen attempts to rouse someone at the digital office in Munich, Lenhardt finally spoke with a public relations woman and challenged her directly. "This doesn't look very good for DEC," he said, hoping to chisel loose a response. "I know, but we can't say anything," came the answer. On September 15th, the show aired, declaring that NASA's top-secret network had been violated. File footage of the shuttle hurtling into space filled television screens throughout the Federal Republic, as if to imply that as a result of their wanderings inside the NASA computers, the hackers could manipulate a shuttle launch. The journalists even interviewed Obelix, citing him as an outside computer security expert. Obelix commented on the hackers as if he had no idea who they were. The program threw Digital's Munich office into some disarray. West German hackers discovering a gaping hole in Digital's operating system was humiliating enough. The fact that they were romping undetected for months was even worse. Finally, NASA confirmed that hackers had been in the SPAN network, but insisted that they had only browsed through insignificant information. For his part, Pengo had kept his distance from the NASA incident. A year had passed since his trip to East Berlin, and he had stopped trying to hack for Sergey. He had gotten no response whatever from his first delivery, none of the feedback he was hoping to see. It was a big disappointment, especially for someone whose ambition had been to become the world's greatest hacker. Moreover, Carl's visits and phone calls had tapered off, a signal that he wasn't placing much stock in Pengo's contributions any longer. There had been no formal ouster, but Pengo figured he was no longer part of the group. It appeared that the whole espionage affair was dying down. It even looked as if the hackers weren't going to get caught. Pengo's attention had turned to other things. He was looking for a way to go straight. He had just started his own small company with a friend in Berlin named Clemens. Called NetMBX, the small firm would write networking software, do some consulting, and run an electronic bulletin board. Starting out with Clemens's equipment and the merest whiff of startup capital, the two budding entrepreneurs set up shop in a cramped little office on the outskirts of West Berlin. Pengo was still enrolled at the technical university, but he neglected his studies to flirt with the possibilities of capitalism. He joked that he was becoming a yuppie.